Hi there, welcome to We Need to Talk, a podcast that helps empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter, who range in age from 16 up to 33 years. Each episode, I'm talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from mental health to climate change, from pornography to bullying. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This episode, I had the great honour of talking with author and leading activist Thomas Mayer, who carried the Uluru Statement from the Heart around Australia for 18 months from 2017. Thomas explains the three key elements of the Uluru Statement: voice, treaty, and truth. In particular, why our country needs an enshrined Indigenous voice to Parliament. Our discussion helps to dispel confusion around what effect this change to our constitution will have, and makes clear why this action is vital to the well-being of our First Nations people and therefore to our nation as a whole. So sit back and enjoy this truly enlightening and inspirational talk with the irrepressible Thomas Mayer. Hello, Thomas Mayer. Thank you so much for joining. We need to talk about such a vital topic, the Uluru Statement from the Heart. You are one of the main advocates for this cause. First of all, before we get talking about how it started and why it started, I just want to ask, Thomas, have you been cloned? Because you seem to be everywhere. Whenever I look at anything to do with this, you are everywhere, aren't you? And you are so involved. So have you been cloned?
No, I haven't. I'm just working very hard.
Oh.
Because I know this is only a once-in-generations opportunity, and we'll have a date for a referendum very soon. So just got to get stuck into it and make sure we win.
Absolutely. It's such an exciting time. So can I ask you, the Uluru Statement from the Heart, why did it come about and how did it come about?
Yeah, well, it came about, well, the reason why is because we're still in a crisis. My people have been in crisis since colonization began, since Captain Cook opened the floodgates to the British invaders and all the genocide and forced assimilation and cruelties and neglect that followed that. Still continue today in what no one can deny are statistics that we should be ashamed of in this nation. They're not just statistics, they're human beings, proportionately the most incarcerated on the planet. We have life expectancy that's around 8 years less than other Australians. We have terrible outcomes in education and employment. All of these things make up this crisis that we're in. And I think the Uluru Statement is really important in the way that it articulates very simply that these issues that we have cannot be because we are Indigenous, that these issues are a structural and political problem that can be fixed with constitutional change. And so that's why it came about. The way it came about was through a series of 13 three-day regional dialogues covering the entire continent and adjacent islands, a well-formulated, well-resourced, Indigenous-led process that took several years. The process ensured that the thousands of Indigenous people that participated in it were well-informed, not just about how civics works, how our constitution works, but also about the history of our struggle and about many other statements and petitions and different committees and inquiries that have been held that ultimately provide us with the lessons that are in the Uluru Statement. And so the Uluru Statement is a culmination of all of that.
That was presented in 2017. So after years of putting it together, it was then presented to the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull and co, and rejected.
Yeah, I think it's important there, though, to note that first it was presented to our people, right? So these 13 dialogues elected delegates to come together in the heart of the country at Uluru for one final three-day convention. And that's where it was authored, really. It was the records of meetings from all of the dialogues that preceded it came together and we worked really hard, our people, the hard work of consensus building to come up with a set of words that we hoped that the delegates, you know, it was 250 delegates from all around the country, would endorse collectively. And that's what happened on the final day. Yeah. And when it was presented, after all that hard work, after not just thinking about the lessons from the past and presenting in the statement a way forward, that took those lessons and ensured it was a way that empowered us, but also the thinking about what the broader Australian public could accept. So it wasn't just pie in the sky or even motherhood type stuff, like broad and not specific enough, but it really nailed down on a set of proposals that the Australian people could accept and that we had confidence would give us the power that we needed to ensure that there was fairness and equality towards us in this country and a better relationship. And that's what we did.
Yeah, and not just what's focused on what's right for our Indigenous community, but what's right for our nation as a whole, because it's going to be better for our nation as a whole to have an enshrined voice to Parliament and the treaty and the truth. Can we talk about the three main components of the Uluru Statement from the Heart? So first up, voice. Can you please explain what that entails and why it needs to be enshrined in our constitution?
Yeah, so the words in the statement is, we call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the constitution. So the reason why it calls for that is because we need a voice. I think when we're talking about a voice, we're talking about a representative body, and Australia is a representative democracy. So nobody should wonder, oh, what is a voice? Like, what is a representative body? I mean, there's loads of them. There's unions with different rules and different setups. There's the business council, there's industry representative groups, and Parliament itself, both state and federal, they're representative bodies. So there should be nothing confusing about that. But the key thing is that it calls for a constitutionally enshrined voice, which is about protecting it. Because our people throughout the history of our struggle have established representative bodies that have been always silenced by hostile authorities and governments. So a constitution is simply a rule book, the highest set of laws that even the politicians must follow. So we're just saying we want the Australian people, who are the only ones that can determine what is in the constitution by way of referendum, we want them to say, we want First Nations people to have a representative body protected by the constitution.
Because if it's not protected, it's open to change, isn't it? In further governments, we need to have that protected always in the constitution.
That's right. And it's just a principle that there will be a voice that we're protecting in the constitution. The model, so the way that people will be elected, the composition of the voice, the powers and functions of the voice, the processes of the voice, that'll all be flexible. That's determined by the parliament, because necessarily you need to have flexibility to continuously improve the way the voice runs, how it is able to speak on behalf of Indigenous people and help to make a difference. And also that flexibility is important to the voice being able to evolve with the needs of the people. And so when we're talking about constitutionally enshrining a voice, it's always important to remember that when the referendum comes around, all we're saying is that there will be a voice. The details come afterwards. They're very simple, those other things. Because I said, it's not surprising. There's loads of representative bodies.
Yes. And before the referendum will happen, and there's a good chance it will happen next year, before the end of the year, would you say that?
Yeah, certainly. So the commitment of the Albanese Labor government is that there will be a referendum in this term of Parliament. So that's his promise,
yep,
to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. If he waits till the last year of this term of Parliament, it's getting a bit close to an election.
Yes.
So late next year is a credible option.
Absolutely. How exciting is that? That's not that far away. So we talk about power that our Indigenous people will have. A lot of people get confused. They think it's going to have power over our Parliament, but it's really empowering our Indigenous people to have a say over policies that affect them. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a third chamber, as some people have fear-mongered about. It's not going to have a rights of veto what the parliament does or pass laws on its own. It's merely an advisory body. And I shouldn't say merely, that doesn't make it powerless that it's only advisory to parliament. The power in it comes from a sensible, informed and cohesive advice from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people all around the country on the issues that are common to us. And also what we think is in the best interest of Australia. We've got a lot to offer there. If we were heard on how to look after country, on climate change, on how to dispute resolution, we're masters of dispute resolution. We're not the longest continuing civilization on the planet because we're warmongers or anything like that. I mean, we have hundreds of different, very unique Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages on one common continent. And that is because we knew what country we belonged to, because we were able to resolve disputes amongst each other. So we've got lots to offer to the parliament just by giving advice.
Oh, totally. Over 60,000 years of experience there. And you just mentioned climate change. I mean, look how much they've been drawing on the Indigenous experience there to address issues with climate change in Australia. You must be jumping up and down still about the result of the last election. I mean, it is wonderful that at the beginning of his acceptance speech, the new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said an Indigenous voice to Parliament enshrined is a major focus of his. How did you feel when you heard that?
Yeah, I was physically jumping for joy. Yeah.
So was I.
Yeah. I mean, I was at Garma several weekends ago, the Garma Festival in Northeast Arnhem Land.
Yep.
The leader of the country, you know, traveled all the way to Garma, and I was in the crowd listening to his speech, and he reaffirmed that commitment. And further, he laid out some draft words that should be considered by all Australians about what the constitutional provision will be, so the amendment, which is three simple sentences, and also what the question might be.
Yes.
And sitting in the crowd, listening to that, hearing a prime minister that, you know, you couldn't miss it. He genuinely wants to achieve this.
Yes.
I had tears in my eyes. Just so much hard work to see a leader of the country actually trust that what we have called for is important and to understand what a gift that is to all Australians. Just a really special moment.
Oh, wow. Well, it's nation building, really, isn't it? Anything positive like this that's going to be included in the Constitution is so wonderful for our nation. It really is.
You know that it's nation building. It really is a nation building thing. The reason why most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people support this is because they see this as a unifying moment.
Yes.
Which speaks to the generosity of Indigenous people, most Indigenous people. That there is this desire to move forward in a way where we're given the respect and everything that we deserve. And the respect that we are seeking is simply to be heard when decisions are going to be made that affect our people. Should have been done in 1901 when the Constitution was first made, you know, when Australia became a federation.
Yep.
It should have been done then. And I think most Australians would agree.
Oh, absolutely. What do you say to the naysayers? And we get some naysayers on both sides, don't we, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, that say, look, we need to be focusing on closing the gap rather than having an enshrined voice. What do you say there? I mean, they're really intertwined, aren't they? And Professor Megan Davis has said this in her wonderful book, and I'll mention your great books. She's written a book, Everything You Need to Know About the Uluru Statement from the Heart, with a co-author, and she says it'll be much better for the mental health of our Indigenous Australians to have it enshrined in the Constitution and show that respect whilst we're addressing the closing the gap issues.
Yeah, yeah. I say to the naysayers, for those that genuinely want progress for Indigenous people, this is the most practical thing that we can do to help our people. Everything that is a problem for our people, whether it's crowded housing, whether it's a social dysfunction, whether it's the way services are delivered in our communities or water that you can't drink in some communities. whether it's about the justice system, everything is affected by the decisions that are made in Parliament. It is all linked to that. And again, we're a representative democracy. And in a representative democracy, there is nothing more practical than being able to be heard, to be able to influence those decisions. And it's not like we can't do more than one thing at the same time. So we should be building this power for Indigenous people to be heard at the same time.
Exactly.
As we're doing the other thing, right?
Yes.
At the same time. And then when we achieve the voice, it's only going to add power to how we get those other things done. So for the naysayers that are saying it's not practical, that it's only symbolic, that, you know, it's the same old elites and that, I'd say you're wrong. Think about what I just said. You're wrong. There are some naysayers that will never shift on this because they don't really want progress. And for those naysayers that are talking about a lack of detail, I think it's fair enough to want to know what the model will look like. But again, that shouldn't stop people from enshrining the principle that we should be heard, right?
Yep.
So don't confuse what the referendum is about. The model is something that will be flexible, that the parliament will determine in consultation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Yes, and that'll happen. I mean, there'll be information, as Anthony Albanese has said, information released about that model before the referendum. But in principle, the main thing that will be voted on in the referendum is respect for our First Nations people's voice to be heard in Parliament over issues that will affect them directly and also that will affect the whole country as well. They will be heard and listened to.
That's right. That's all it is. And there's going to be those naysayers that are entrenched in their position. So they're actually people that just oppose any progress for Indigenous people. And I want people to understand that when you hear from those people, just be aware that some will be saying those things just to confuse people. Because that is our worst enemy in this, is confusion.
Yep.
So I just ask the listeners to keep that in mind. When you're talking about it with others, always try and bring them back to the very simple reason we're doing this. It's about recognizing that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people should have been in our founding document from the beginning, and recognition is something that's important to us as a nation. And then secondly, that it's just fair. It's just good manners, as Albo says,
yes,
to consult with the people before you make decisions about them. And the best way to do that is a representative body.
Absolutely. And it's about shared sovereignty, isn't it? Totally. Thomas, shared sovereignty, would you say?
Yeah. I mean, our sovereignty was never ceded. It was never extinguished. I mean, the Uluru Statement basically says that sovereignty continues. It's a spiritual notion, which means it's more than some legal thing that depends on the Constitution. For example, the Constitution in 1901 could have said there's no such thing as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander sovereignty. It wouldn't have made any difference because we still would be here and we would still have been fighting for our rights.
That's right.
And to be heard.
Yes.
Yeah. But really, it's how do we bring this together? Again, that unifying moment where, you know, our children can walk in two worlds and our culture will be a gift to their country, as the Uluru Statement says.
Yeah. And it is an invitation, isn't it? Let's get talking about the treaty part, how the Makarrata Commission, which oversees treaty and truth telling, if you can explain a bit about that, thanks.
Yeah. So the other very specific things that the Uluru Statement calls for is through a Makarrata Commission, that there be a process of truth telling to the nation and agreement making or treaties. Makarrata is a Yolngu word. It comes from Northeast Arnhem Land, comes from the Yolngu people, and it's a dispute resolution process is what it's talking about. The disputing parties come together with the truth in their hearts, and when they reach an agreement, they have a closer relationship than before. That's generally what it is. So truth-telling, and we say agreement-making and not treaty in the Uluru Statement because our people all around the country talked about the various types of agreements that we do, right? So treaty isn't the only agreement making that we do. There's Inuwas, there's or Indigenous land use agreements, there's social compacts. There are various agreements that are negotiated by our people. with governments and corporations and others. But for treaty, it's the culminating agenda of the Uluru State. Treaties are underway. I think most Australians accept that, especially when they learn that we are way behind similar Western democracies.
Like New Zealand and Canada and America, they've all got treaties with their indigenous peoples.
Correct.
And here we are, way behind in that respect. So it is so important we do have a treaty. And a makarrata, as you were saying, actually means coming together after a struggle. And that is a unity building process. And it's just so wonderful to have. And why is it so important? Like, you had another political party, the Greens, say, look, we should have treaty before an enshrined voice. Why is it so important to have the enshrined voice first?
Well, it's important because it just makes sense. It's just simple negotiation 101 or even nation building 101, right? It's a bit nonsensical to say before we establish representation for a large amount of people, over 800,000, I think, in the last census, that we would get a good agreement. Like, No, that's not the way things are done.
No.
I come from the union movement. You don't get a good enterprise agreement before you have a union, right?
No.
It just doesn't make sense. Look, and so it's just a matter of strategy and common sense. But also, this is important to consider as well. In the dialogues, in the lead up to the making of the Uluru Statement, many of our people said that they had already been through a lot of agreement. As I said, there are other types of agreements that we did, even treaty as well. I mean, Victoria's been going for 10 years now. So they're very complex treaties when you're over 200 years after first contact. So it's different to New Zealand and Canada. But they said that agreement making had been very arduous. It was difficult. Tactics played, the divisions in our communities and in our families, native title, very, very difficult. And a lot of people said, we're actually not ready for treaty, or acknowledge that treaty is going to take a very long time because there needs to be a treaty amongst ourselves. There's a lot of work to be done to understand whose country is what, who's speaking for who, and all that sort of stuff. So that's why a lot of people lent towards a voice first. Because the voice is also a vehicle to bring our people together and sort our own backyard out, really, before we start negotiating that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So a voice overarches all of it, really, doesn't it? To have that enshrined in our constitution, it overarches treaty and truth-telling with respect for our First Nations people.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word overarch. I would say that it supports it. It's a supporting mechanism or vehicle for treaty, because you see, treaties are done in multiple states now, Queensland, Victoria, South Australia will kick it off again soon, the Northern Territory as well. These are being done in the states and territories, and so a national representative body with the empowerment of the constitution is important to having the discussion with the federal government about their obligations in the states and territories, right? They're the big power in this country.
Yeah. I wanted to mention about the 1967 referendum, which was the most successful referendum in Australia. Only 8 have got up out of 44. And of course, that was in relation to respect for our First Nations people, them being included in the census. So I think 94-95% of Australians voted in favour. And the populace, when we look at polls at the moment, most people are saying, yes, we would support enshrinement in the constitution, but they're saying they're just a bit confused about what the Uluru Statement from the heart means. That's why I'm having this discussion with you and why you're getting out talking to so many other people, just so they understand what it means. And that's why education and addressing that confusion is so important, isn't it, Thomas?
Yeah, it's really important. So listeners, share this podcast around.
Oh, don't worry. I will. Yeah. And I wanted to mention truth-telling, what that involves and what that really means.
Truth-telling wasn't an option for reform that was in the dialogues, but it was something that came through in all of the dialogues, that our people have a strong desire for truth-telling in this country. And truth-telling is important because it's one of the things that can move people to vote yes. But also it's part of the healing, right? It's part of healing this nation for that truth to be heard, for it to be known, for it to be accepted. Now, the truth also needs a voice. So while we say we need more truth telling, it's an ongoing thing. We've done loads of truth telling already. Documentaries, movies, books. We have access to the journals of explorers, and there's all sorts of truth telling that's been done. Reconciliation weeks and NAIDOC weeks for decades now have been, you know, really making sure that the truth is being heard more and more. Royal Commission reports full of truth telling. This is the hardcore truth telling, right? It is backed by evidence, backed by all of the evidence. And so what I'm getting to here is that I think the truth is known enough to move the nation.
And when we talk about truth telling, we're talking about what happened from European colonization. Is that correct? And the horror that happened to our First Nations people from that time.
That's correct. Though it's just one part of the other important truth telling is, as I was saying about royal commissions, it's about why things are the way they are today. So why are we incarcerated in such numbers? What are the factors that lead to that? You know, it's partly actually because of crowded housing, which is one of the things that inflame social dysfunction. It's that people and communities are crowded into houses. There hasn't been new housing for a long time. The cost of healthy food is something that leads there. So there's truth telling around all of that. The deaths in custody. The Royal Commission into deaths in custody was over 20 years. And this is where I'm going, that truth telling is important. It's ongoing. But the politicians that make the decisions, that ignore the recommendations in the Royal Commission reports, they know the truth. And so what's missing is the voice to be able to use the truth to get outcomes. Okay. So the voice is a priority, an absolute priority.
Absolutely. And you talk about incarceration. I mean, Indigenous people make up 3% of the population, yet make up 30% of those incarcerated. So there's a massive disconnect there, isn't there? There's a massive problem.
And it's not because my children are different from other children because they're Indigenous and they're going to struggle to understand right from wrong because of their culture. That's why that part of the Uluru Statement is so important, where it says, proportionately, we're the most incarcerated people on the planet.
We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are alien from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them.
It's like, it's just saying to people, hang on. If you believe that this is an Indigenous problem, then maybe that's a racist thought that you're having.
Yep.
Because we're not different from other human beings. This is a structural and political problem that can be fixed with constitutional change.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, first of all, just before I ask you this question, I did hear Malcolm Turnbull being interviewed last night. I'm not sure if you did. And he said he's had time to reflect in the last 5 years and he would support and he would tick yes for a referendum calling for an enshrined voice to Parliament. That's great to hear. He was talking about that it would still involve a lot of power, but again, what we spoke about a while ago was it would be empowering our First Nations people. Did you find that heartening to hear that he's changed his mind?
Yeah, I think Turnbull nailed it. It's not a third chamber to Parliament. It's advisory to Parliament, but it's a powerful thing that a Parliament that ignores the advice of something that the Australian people say through a referendum should be respected and listened to. I think Turnbull nailed it. He understands it. And it was heartening to see him change his stance on this. He also said that he believes the Australian people will vote yes to it. And so that's the sort of confidence that we're looking for. I'm not going to get hung up on what Turnbull did back in 2017. That's part of history now. As long as a person can say, okay, I might have got this wrong, or my concerns have been addressed, and I'm going to move forward and I'm going to confidently say to others that they should vote yes to. That's the best that we can hope for.
Yes, and reflecting on past mistakes and learning from them and to say what's right now. I just wanted to ask you how amazing it was that you carried the Uluru Statement from the Heart around our nation for 18 months, and that was following when it was presented, is that correct, in 2017. What was that experience like?
Yeah, so I was entrusted to take that sacred canvas. It's the most sacred document ever in Australia and will be for a very long time. It was a great honour to be able to do that. I did it with the support of my union, the Maritime Union of Australia, which was important because there was no money in this campaign. You know, when Turnbull dismissed it back in 2017, we had nothing. And so the union seconding me to this movement was very important to beginning the people's movement that we built to this point today where we could actually change the nation. It was scary,
yeah.
To be honest. I mean, it was a scary experience and it was really, really hard because there was misinformation from both the far right and not so far right and also the far left in the ways of saying that this wasn't important or this wasn't powerful enough or that the process was not extensive enough. And so I was copying it from all sides as I traveled the country, taking it to places. But what I learned is that when people hear the truth about this and how it was made and the wonderful consensus that was reached and how much work that took and then how these reforms are so generous but powerful, a great majority are moved to say, yeah, we'll support this and are inspired. And that was the experience that I had. But I was always afraid of losing it or someone attacking it and this very sacred object.
Yes.
But I was prepared to protect it with my life, yeah.
I was reading at a couple of airports, you're a little bit nervous when it was arriving, is that right? Coming out through luggage or,
yeah.
Or did you always carry it with you?
Yeah, I had to check it into oversized luggage and yeah, it was always great anxiety waiting for it to come out. Yeah.
I bet you didn't have any problem recognizing it when it came out. And can you just talk a little bit about the book that you formed from that experience too?
Yeah, Finding the Heart of the Nation is the first ever book that I wrote. I never expected to write a book. I was a warfie for 16 years and I didn't do that well in school, though I did well in year 11 English because I had a good teacher and I learnt that using big words and, you know, to move people was sort of elaborating on things could help. But yeah, Finding the Heart of the Nation has been a great success. Interviews with 20 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people really about why they support it. But it talks more than about the Uluru Statement. It talks about the Uluru Statement in an indirect way, about their lives, about the issues they've faced in their communities, the hopes and dreams and what's worked well, just generally about life. And
yep.
I've just done a second edition. So that comes out on the 19th of October.
Oh, great.
And there's new sections. I've rewritten the introduction and the conclusion to suit the times.
Great. I bought the book and my husband and I loved it. And you've also done one that relates to children, really, haven't you? Which shares the Uluru Statement from the Heart and why it's so important. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's the most successful book that I've got is the children's book about the Uluru Statement. It's called Finding Our Heart. The illustrator is Black Douglas.
Wow. And
Black Douglas won the Archibald this year.
Yeah, I love the painting. Fantastic. And the other book, of course, you've written, which I also bought and we loved, Dear Son, about Indigenous fathers talking about their relationship with their children, but also some talking about their relationships with their fathers, their own fathers. And that's a fantastic insight into, issues around masculinity, issues around relationships. Can you mention a little bit about that one?
Yeah, Dear Son is one of my proudest works, really, because it's very personal. It's an anthology of letters from mostly fathers to sons, some sons to fathers. And yeah, it's about all of those things. It's not all doom and gloom, really. It's a celebration of who we are. And I write in the introduction that when Indigenous men, when First Nations men love ourselves, we're better able to care and love our families. And that in itself is an act of defiance, that after all the things that in my generation we were taught that our forefathers were savages, unintelligent, that the intervention was Prime Minister Howard basically announcing to all Australians that domestic violence and child abuse was an Aboriginal problem, by the racist publications like Elite Cartoons. So the book is a celebration, and it's for everybody, not just men, not just Indigenous men. It's for all genders and all families to learn from.
That's what I thought looking at it. It applies to all men, non-Indigenous and Indigenous, really, and all people who are very interested in that focus on males and their relationships with their kids, etc. I thought it was fantastic. Before we finish, Thomas, I'm going to ask you if you can please recite. You can probably do it in your sleep nowadays, right? But before we get to that, reciting the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which would be an honour to have that recorded here on this podcast, is there anything that you want to say right now that's really there at the forefront for yourself?
I just want to say to the listeners that this referendum is not just a once-in-a-generation opportunity, it's once in generations. This is our time, you know, all Australians, this is our time to do something that is lasting and that really is nation building. As you said, Jane, really is nation building. And so what I say to people is, have the confidence in yourself to advocate for this. Have the courage to advocate for this. And don't waste time. Start now. And don't think that what you can do within your capacity is too small an action. If it's just sharing the Uluru Statement with everyone in your area, all the people that you're connected to, that is in itself action. So that's what I want to say to people. Take this opportunity and let's build a better future for our children.
Totally. Because it is a ripple effect. We're all working as a team for the same aim, which will benefit our nation and send a wonderful message overseas too. We're a global community nowadays, and I think it would be a wonderful thing for our global community as well. Having said that, the Uluru Statement from the Heart, we'll finish on that powerful note. Go for it, Thomas.
We gathered at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This, our ancestors did, according to the reckoning of our culture, from the creation, according to the common law, from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature, and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished, and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise? That a people's possessed a land for 60 millennia, and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionately, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are alien from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youths languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is a torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional change to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our own destiny, our children will flourish. They will walk in two worlds, and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is a culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination. We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement making between governments and First Nations, a truth telling about our history. In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard. We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. We invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future.
Wow, what a fantastic way to finish our talk. It's just wonderful. It feels it, doesn't it, that we're part of an exciting time in our history, the history of our country, would you say?
Yes, it is. Take a hold of this opportunity and let's build a better future for our children, as Uluru's statement says.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Thomas, for your time today.
Thank you, Jane. I've really enjoyed doing this podcast.
Next episode, I'm talking with social justice advocate and mother of five, Catherine Knox, about our personal experiences of postnatal depression. Catherine and I go way back to 2003 when I interviewed her for my PhD research on this serious mental health issue. I'm calling this episode 11 Sons, 2 Daughters, because between us, that's the mix of our kids. I hope you'll join us for this very frank and open discussion, and until then, take good care of yourselves and each other, and remember, knowledge is power.